from one side of the world to the other. Can you believe it? My guest is Lauren Weinstein, and this is going to be your opportunity this hour. I've certainly had enough fun with him to ask him any sort of question you would like. Now, if you're like me, even hearing all of this scary stuff, it's certainly not going to be enough to get me to put down my keyboard. I don't know about you, but still, this has been some worrisome stuff. So if you have questions about what you've heard, he's the guy to ask, and you know how to do it. Those are the numbers. So in a moment, all of you and Lauren Weinstein. Well, all right, Lauren, are you ready for the general public?
I am ready and willing here.
All right, well, here they come. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Lauren Weinstein and Art Bell. Hi.
Hello, Art, Lauren, and listeners. I'm Andy in Columbia, South Carolina.
Hi, Andy.
Yes, sir.
Hey, in Philippines, it's interesting to talk to across the world, around the world like this. I have a couple of points that will be comfort and reassurance to people who are facing long, aggravating power outages, and the second point will be just in general, you know, all the time, and y'all can brush up on any fine points. I'm interdisciplinary multi-science research, and therefore can generally dig only so deep in any one field. The electric utilities, whether they're private or public, have absolutely no economic interest in downtime. They don't make money unless those meters are turning, other than any fixed costs, like what they sometimes call a facilities charge. And therefore, they're with the customer in the eagerness to get the power back on. And I've written the IBEW headquarters, care of the AFL-CIO in Washington, D.C., the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, advocating some kind of bonus to be paid for a reward for deliberate yet cautious pace of work. I say that because the power load is potentially lethal, both in the transmission circuit, which is between the power generating station and the electrical substation near the customer.
Well, I don't think anybody's saying that they're not doing the very best they can. We're saying the infrastructure is not capable of delivering the kind of demand that there is presently. That's what we were saying. Now, you had another question?
Yeah, and the second point is something interesting to customers in general. The electric meter, somebody called a local talk show and was begrudging the fact he was having to pay for not only the electricity he was using, but also the electricity to turn the meter. That meter turning is not a cost to the customer because there's no electric motor in there. It's simply the fact that a half positively magnetized, half negatively magnetized wheel, carefully balanced.
Yeah. Is all right, well, I think I've right, I've got that. You don't pay for the meter turning. If you want to scare, go watch it turn. Wildcard Line, you are on the air with Lauren Weinstein. Hello.
Good evening, Art. Good evening. How are you doing?
Just fine, sir.
Wow, it is so cool to talk to you. I've never talked to you before, but I'm for sure a longtime listener. Hey, I got a quick question for Lauren.
Sure.
What would you think about securing the PC? I know a lot, some companies are out there doing it now, but securing your PC at the mouse and the keyboard level where you would actually interface with your computer.
Well, what do you mean by secure?
I was thinking maybe taking a scan of maybe the bottom part of your palm.
So you're talking about a biometric identification system of some sort.
Correct.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Actually, right. There have been it's kind of interesting, of course. I'm seeing ads now on I guess for Best Buy or Circuit City or one of them where they're promoting fingerprint identification for new laptops for students to buy to go back to school.
Lauren, I've got it right on the Vio in front of me has a little fingerprint scan.
Yeah.
I have not activated it yet. I'm afraid of it.
Well, I mean, the real problem is it's pretty problematic how much use those things really are, because if someone's going to go after your computer and they're going to have physical access to it, mm-hmm. they're probably just going to rip the disk out.
And, well, that's true.
And they're not going to care too much about the... And right now, of course, most disks contain unencrypted data. That might change in the future, but for now... it's easy enough to bypass those things. It was interesting, though, he mentioned keyboards, because there were actually experiments some years back with security systems that would detect the cadence of the way you typed. In other words, it wasn't just typing the right password, but you had to type it in your characteristic fashion. But a lot of those didn't really pan out because people tend to be, you know, kind of sloppy. But
I'm not sure why. Should I be afraid of this? I mean, I love Vio. It's just absolutely the best. But my Vio has a little fingerprint thing on it, and you've got to activate it.
Those things aren't really – the way most of those things are implemented, they don't even really take your whole fingerprint or anything. They're just measuring certain points, a limited set of parameters. So it's sort of a harmless toy. And I wouldn't be too worried about it, but I wouldn't put a lot of faith in it either.
Well, my worry was something would change or it wouldn't remember it properly, and I'd never get back into my computer. Maybe that's a silly worry.
Or you suffer an injury on your finger.
Well, I hadn't even thought about
that. There are always ways to bypass those things. I mean,
I'm not good with super glue. I'd probably super glue my finger.
There are always ways to bypass, but you bring up a very interesting point, which is, and this is a real serious issue. There's all this push now for biometrics in identifications,
in
ID cards and for all kinds of access systems and all that, especially for ID cards. They talk about for border control, all of this. And you have to wonder what happens to people whose biometric information is compromised. It can be compromised in the database. It can be compromised by cloning. There's a professor out there somewhere who has made a very nice hobby out of cloning fingerprints. He started with gummy bears and developed the technique for that and gradually got more sophisticated. And he can fool these fingerprint systems a large percentage of the time, even if they want body heat, you know, detect the heat as well as the fingerprint. So what happens when somebody compromises your fingerprint data or your iris data or your retinal data or something like that? What do you
think? I was going to ask about retinal scans.
Yeah, well, all these things are subject to being compromised with varying degrees of difficulty. And then the poor person who has been compromised is kind of in a box, because you can't easily go out and buy a new retina or buy a new fingerprint or buy a new iris. Mm-hmm. Your biometrics in general are unchangeable. So once that has been compromised, you're pretty much up the creek. And this is a part of biometrics that isn't discussed because, of course, we're sold the bill of goods on all the 21st century high-tech aspects of it and not the down-to-earth ways that they can screw up.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Lauren Weinstein. Hello.
Oh,
hello.
Hey, all right.
Yes.
This is Hank, fellow Ham.
Yes, hi, Hank.
It got kind of a crash of noise there when you brought me up. I swear I wasn't sure you had me on. I just had to comment about the voting machines that was discussed a little earlier. We have it out here in Orange County. We're using them, and it's not touch. It's not a touch screen. It's you got to turn the little dial, but it does have the paper record, as was mentioned, which I think is great. I had severe misgivings when we first started, but after I looked into it more completely, I decided these are okay. But the main reason I called was to talk to you about another voting method maybe you've heard about called IRV, instant runoff voting.
No.
Okay, well, the way it works is it eliminates the need for runoff elections. So think about the millions of dollars we save and how few people turn out for runoffs.
This is the one where you take the highest and then the next and
right.
Yeah.
You vote for your preference in order of vote for your candidates in order of preference 1, 2, 3, 4 and so on. Because how many times have you not voted for your first choice because you knew they had little chance of winning and there was somebody else you definitely did not want to win, so you voted for somebody else that was your second or third choice that had a better chance of winning?
Yeah, that's a very interesting system. I mean, the part about it that kind of makes me wonder, though, is are you going to be able to explain it to people in a reasonable way where there won't be a lot of people afterwards filing lawsuits saying that people didn't understand how it worked?
Well, I might have been one of those because I'm just now hearing about this. I had no idea. So the whole ideas to eliminate runoffs?
Yeah, I mean, the idea is basically to say that instead of just having one person that you're voting for, you have preferences. And
wow.
Then those preferences, you know, from top to bottom, essentially, are then used to determine who the winner is. But it is difficult to explain. And for that reason, I think it may have considerable problems being widely adopted in general type elections in this country. But time will tell, I guess. That's not really a technology issue. It's just an issue of how you define winning.
Sure. First time caller line. You're on the air with Lauren Weinstein and Art Bell. Hi.
Good evening, Lauren. How you doing, Art?
Hi there.
It's great
fine.
To talk to you guys. Long-time listener, Art. I was in a traveling band, and you got me from point A to point B many nights.
Talk radio really is fantastic for that, isn't it? A long trip, it just goes whizzing right by. Go right ahead.
I've done some major stretches listening. I wanted to talk to Lauren. I wanted to touch on your topic before. By the way, listening on Streamlink and chatting with all the Coast Riders and the Streamlink forums, talking to you actually on a Vonage phone through a T1 connection. I run a web hosting company, so I'm into tonight's show extremely. In reference to before about certain companies thinking about privatizing networks and charging for access to those networks, how can large companies like Google and companies like that consider even charging, because you know Google will be involved in that, they're buying up everything else anyway, but how can they charge for access when they themselves are costing web hosters and costing website owners money in the form of bandwidth from their crawling, you know, just to catalog pages for their search engines, and the hosters are paying for that. And I know a lot of my websites, even small ones, they're paying for about a gigabyte a month of Google traffic and Inkatomi Slurp and all these other search web crawlers. I don't see how these companies are going to get away with it.
Well, you're sort of taking the anti-net neutrality stance, I'd say here. You're taking the ISP stance on this,
right?
Which is the opposite of my stance, and that's good. That's good. I like this. I think the issue here is that Google or anybody, any service provider, Google gets used as an example a lot because they're big and obvious, and they're the 800-pound gorilla right now.
Right.
But they are paying massive amounts of money for access to the internet right now. They pay, when an individual...
Because they're not paying any part of my T1 bill.
Well,
and that's access that I'm paying for that they are using.
But that's the whole principle involved here. You pay for access to the network, you pay for bandwidth to the network, and everybody pays for access, and then you move the data around. Now, the issue of crawling is a very simple one, in that crawling can be, you can tell crawling to stop.
Yeah.
Well, wait a minute. What's crawling?
Crawling is when a search engine or any internet site sends out probes that look through the web pages. That's how these indexes are built up of information. So Google, for example, has processes, computers that go out, and they're looking at web pages and reading them and then build their indexes. So when you put a search in, it can figure it out.
All right, robots.
Right, robots. In fact,
basically,
the method for controlling these things...
Robots.txt.
...is robots.txt. And you can say, Google, stay away, if that's what you want to do.
But most people aren't informed of that, especially, you know, most of your average public that's buying websites and first-time hosters, and even long-time hosters. They don't, you know, they don't understand these methods, and they're still incurring the cost.
Well, I think robots.txt is very widely known among, I mean, most of the ISPs I look at now in their introductory information for people setting up websites discuss that.
Not many people pay attention to that, though.
Well,
we're talking about the general public.
It's very difficult. You know, we could say the same thing about software license agreements, right?
True.
People don't pay attention, they don't read them, and they get into trouble. But in this case, a bigger issue is that if you pay for access to the network and you pay for the bandwidth that you're going to use, how do you ever deal with all of the potential administrative points along the way who might say, well, I want a cut of that also? It's from a purely logistical standpoint, it's a nightmare. Now, if we want to go down that path, if that's the way we want to go, then people have to realize that most of the services that they get for free now aren't going to be free anymore. There has to be a trade-off somewhere. If you want to charge as an ISP, if you want to charge a service provider, be it Google, a service application such as Google or someone else, Yahoo or whoever, and you want to say, well, you've got to pay me because you're using my bandwidth to get to my customer, then you'd better expect to have to pay to use those services. Now, maybe that's another discussion we need to have, but I think that if we go down that path, we're going to end up in a situation where small entrepreneurs who could turn out the next great development are going to be locked out. Because right now, you can buy access to the internet, and you have equal access pretty much with anybody else for the bandwidth you buy. If the price of entry for new services and new ideas on the internet is paying everybody all along the line for bandwidth, then we are not going to have those kinds of services. If that's the way you want to go, perhaps that's a possibility, but I would prefer to see the model where we have a neutral internet, you buy your access at the point where you connect, and we keep the rest as egalitarian as we possibly can.
Let me tell you an interesting story, Lauren. It has to do with people's attitudes about the internet. When Coast to Coast first began, there was no internet. In fact, I had a little BBS up to take care of the traffic and that sort of thing. Then Coast to Coast moved to the network. And in the beginning, when the internet began, we would provide free streaming to the very few people who were listening on the internet. It was not a problem. We just sort of ate the cost of the bandwidth, and we simply provided it. But, you know, then Coast to Coast got bigger, bandwidth became more expensive, and people had a sort of a fixed idea in their mind, because we had provided it for free, that this would always, that the internet was free, that being able to listen to somebody's stream, somebody's program on the internet was just a free thing. And so when we began to have to charge, which of course we did for Streamlink, because of the millions of people and the amount of bandwidth is money. It's just, you know, you can equate bandwidth to money. It's just like gold. And so eventually we had to begin charging for listening to the program, and people went berserk. Why would you start charging for something that was free? I mean, they just totally, by the millions, my friend, went berserk. And only now is it beginning to dawn on the American public and the world's public, I guess, that bandwidth is money. Is that right?
It's big money.
Big money.
It's big money. But the issue here boils down to who is getting charged. So, for example, in your case, the Streamlink case.
Sure.
You have an end user subscriber who is subscribing to a service, and he's paying for it directly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's really nothing wrong with that model.
No. But see, they thought, you know, I pay my internet provider, and so why in the hell should I have to pay for Streamlink?
Well, here's the other side of the question, though, and this is what really cuts to the heart of this controversy. Which is, okay, you have the subscriber who wants to listen to the Art Bell Show over the internet.
Right.
Right? Wants to listen Coast to Coast over the internet.
Right.
And he is paying the show, he's paying Premiere, for example, for access to those streams. Now, he's also paying for his internet access.
Mm-hmm.
Should the phone company who is providing the DSL circuit say, hey, wait a minute here, that's a popular show. I want a cut of the money that Premiere is making. Premiere, you better start paying me. I want 10% of every dollar that people use to access Streamlink, to access Coast to Coast. That's the problem.
Is that going to happen? Yeah, is it going to happen?
The way Congress is behaving right now, it very well could. So Premiere is actually in the same position as Google in this case. The phone companies are liable to be coming along, and the cable companies, if they think they can do it with impunity, and have their hands out and say, you want to access my subscriber? You give me a cut.
God. All right. Hold tight. We're at the bottom of the hour. I had not thought that far ahead. I mean, here I was just thinking about Premiere, getting all of these emails saying, oh, my God, why do I have to pay for that? But now, beyond that, maybe there's going to be the phone company or the cable company wanting a piece of the action. From a high rise in Manila, the Philippines, I'm Art Bell. Well, once again, here I am. What about the attitude, Lauren, and don't answer this just yet, but the attitude that, well, you know, yeah, I'm on the internet, and yeah, I do this and that, and I send email to my friends and all the rest of that, but frankly, the war on terrorism is very important. We also, you know, what happened on 9/11, nobody wants any part of anything like that ever again. So if my communications are monitored, if people are reading my email, well, I'm not really saying anything that I'm ashamed of. I'm not really saying anything that's going to, I don't know, get me slammed in jail or get me audited by the IRS or any of the rest of it. So from my point of view, it's worth it. I wonder how he would answer that question. In a moment, we'll find out. Let's try it in a slightly different way, actually. Lauren, let's say that it's Lauren Weinstein, President of the United States.
Thank you very much.
And I'm your quick promotion, and I'm your national security advisor, and I come to you and I say, look, we understand that there's chatter going on, and there's probably another 9/11 or even worse. Somebody may have a nuclear weapon out there, and it may even be within our borders already, Mr. President. Now, we're asking you to sign an executive order allowing us to monitor all of the internet and telephone communications occurring in the United States and that going internationally as well. Would you as president say, look, no, the answer is no, until we have a national discussion and debate about this issue, I'm going to have to say no? Or would you sign the executive order if you thought there might be a nuclear weapon out there?
Obviously, such a decision would have to be based on the information available at that time. However, based on this hypothetical.
Well, it's hypothetical, I just gave you the criterion.
Yeah, I would say no, but the reason is maybe different than what you might suspect.
Okay.
And the reason I would say no is that I would be extremely concerned that any such broad-based communications monitoring would gather so much useless information that it would hide the very tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of communications that were actually relevant.
Yes, but if you're having to balance that against Cincinnati going up in a mushroom cloud.
But that's completely relevant. I mean, the whole point to surveillance is to target it where it needs to be. When you start doing broad-based surveillance, you obviously run into all the privacy issues, which I'm, you know, for the case of this hypothetical, I'm not getting into, but you know how I feel about that.
I do.
But you also have the problem that if you start looking everywhere, you're not concentrating your efforts where they need to be. And we only have limited resources. We have limited resources for human intelligence, especially translation intelligence, when it comes to the ability to translate. I mean, as you probably know, part of what came out of the 9/11 Commission and other related commissions after various events has been that information had already been collected by some surveillance that might have potentially been relevant, but there was nobody to translate it or to look at it or to analyze it because there was just too much of it. So that says that broad-based surveillance can actually be your enemy.
Well, maybe perhaps for the moment, but will there not come a time when we will have computers that have so much power, Lauren, that they will be able to decipher and decide and pass on to human beings what is potentially interesting and or dangerous?
Anyone who would attempt to make a prediction about the powers of those kinds of machines in the future would be a fool, because it's impossible to imagine where we will be heading in that direction.
Well, it's not impossible to imagine we'll keep going forward.
We will move forward, but exactly where we will end up, I mean, artificial intelligence has been a disappointment for many, many years, but there's always breakthroughs, there's always incremental steps, so the machines are going to become very, very powerful in that regard. You're sort of faced with a twin dilemma here. Mm-hmm. On one side, you have the well-known phrase that people that have done nothing wrong have nothing to hide.
Mm-hmm. Right? That was my other question.
We've all heard that. On the other hand, you have the statements of people whom I assume we respect, like Benjamin Franklin, who took a point of view that if you were giving up privacy to try to get security, you were making a very bad decision. And in fact, enshrined things like, we have now enshrined things like unreasonable search and seizure protections and things like that in the Bill of Rights.
But of course, Benjamin didn't have a high-speed internet connection either.
Nor was he dealing with nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
But the fundamentals remain pretty much the same. We could create a society that was much more secure than what we have now if we choose to do so. But that society will be very, very different than what I suspect most of us want to see. If you want to live in a surveillance police state, that can provide a lot of security. I think you trade a different, you get a different set of problems. And I don't think most of us would want to live in that police state. And again, yeah, as we discussed some time back, have you not lost the war with terror at that point? If you create,
well,
if you create the world of 1984, haven't you lost?
Well, a better question might be, have we not already lost?
No, I don't think we have.
You don't think so?
No, I don't think we have. I think that we have, at this stage, managed to hold on to the fundamental aspects of what make this country great.
Boy, it's a thin line.
My next line was going to, my next statement was going to be, but we are at risk. We are at serious, serious risk. And a lot of it does boil down to oversight. You know, as we move in the direction of more surveillance and more of these kinds of operations, it is utterly critical that there be oversight every step along the way, because without it, that's when reasonable operations turn into abusive operations.
All right. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Lauren Weinstein and Art Bell. Hi.
Yeah, Art. Welcome back on the air. Glad to hear
you. Thank
you. It's been a long time. Okay, in regards to BPL, most of the systems that are in use are carried on the high voltage line, distribution lines, and that's what radiates. And there's a very definite problem with that. Heck, it could even not only interfere with emergency communications on high frequencies, as used by the government, military affiliate radio system, of which I'm a member, HAMS, and so on, could even cause plane crashes by interfering with air communications. There is a low voltage system, which just goes on the power line into the house, but does not get on the high voltage lines, which is clean, as proven by the American Radio Relay League. So hopefully that will be the system which eventually prevails. And, you know, let the market decide. I'm ham like yourself.
I think one of the problems is that if you're only going to use the low voltage system, you have to have a way to get the data to those transmission points, to people's drops, essentially. And that mm-hmm. means building another network, which is a much more expensive proposition than just dumping the data onto the high voltage lines, which is much more economical, but then introduces all of these additional interference problems.
Right. I agree with that. So actually, they'd probably have to run either a fiber optic cable or a coaxial cable from one transformer to the next to be able to do that. But still,
well, that's virtually building a whole new
network.
So, you know, as you pointed out, it's I don't know. It's catch 22, really. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Lauren Weinstein. Hi.
Hey, Art. I had a quick question for your guest, a couple of quick questions, and one quick comment. I think that, when you were talking about the phone lines or the phone companies versus the internet companies earlier, I couldn't help but to draw a parallel between their old technology and the old technology of the oil companies, you know, right now, and their animosity against people with alternative energy. But I guess that's just, capitalistic socialism that we live in. I did have a couple of quick questions for Lauren. The first one was, why are the internet rates for DSL, cable, whatnot, why are they not coming down? They're going up.
Good point.
The second question I had was, does he foresee a day when you actually have to pay for access to each website that you go to, just like TV. You know, TV at one time was free. You went, you know, you turned on the TV, you had these channels that you went to. Of course, now you have to pay for them. And, you know, to make it even more specific, like for Google, for example, will there be a day when you have to pay for, say, we're going to charge you for every 10 inquiries you make, you know,
okay.
Something like that?
All good questions. All right.
Let's see. Question number one first. Why aren't rates going down like they should?
Right.
And I think the short answer to that is that we have seen massive consolidation of internet service providers. There used to be, you know, ISPs on every street corner, basically. And now it has basically boiled down to, for high-speed access anyway, which is what everybody wants, it's the cable company and the phone company for most people, if you have that choice. And as I was saying, only about half the people even have that much choice. When you're in a situation where there's been that kind of consolidation, there isn't a lot of incentive to lower prices. It's the old, you know, Econ 101 again. The second question was, will there come a day when you got to pay for every search or for access to every website? That's the nightmare scenario if this network neutrality kind of issue goes the wrong way. If we don't maintain a neutral internet, that is the kind of thing that could happen. It won't happen tomorrow. It would take time, but the forces would be in play to lead us toward that kind of pay-per-view world that the phone companies and the cable companies would love to see, but that most people using the internet right now don't realize could happen to them very broadly.
How far down the line might something like that nightmare occur if things go the wrong way?
Well, I think what would happen is that we'd see this kind of thing happening first in the areas that are most broadband. I mean, alternative services that were trying to provide audio and video and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the first area, because those would be competing the most directly with the kinds of offerings that the phone companies, for example, want to make, their TV over internet offerings and things of that sort. And that would be where the phone companies would have the most incentive to try to crack down early. If that was successful, if it proved its worth, and if we can, you know, to the phone companies, and if we didn't have any restrictions in place to prevent it from happening, then you would start to see it contaminate broader and broader to websites as other players got involved and said, hey, we want to cut too. You're not just, if this went the wrong way, you could really have a snowball effect, because you don't just have the phone company that the subscriber talks to. What a lot of people don't understand is that your communications can move over, just talking to one website can pop over many different entities.
Well, if you think about it for a moment, Lauren, from the phone company's point of view, not that I'm necessarily wanting to take their side on this, but they are providing these wideband T1, T2, T3, and T4 connections that are carrying the information that is slowly but surely destroying them.
Well, that's an unfortunate situation that their business
for them,
model
yes.
hasn't that their business model hasn't evolved. but essentially, people are paying for all of that bandwidth somewhere. And if you want to go toward a model where to move a packet to an internet site, every individual entity along that path is going to demand a cut, then you can be absolutely sure that you are not going to have free services at some point in the future unless they are supported through some kind of advertising model that's hard to visualize given the way these pricing situations could go.
I agree, but if you look at it from the phone company's point of view, they are providing the wideband connections that are destroying them. And it must be a weird feeling in the boardrooms when they sit around and talk about this. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Lauren Weinstein. Hi.
Yes, my name is Ron, calling from Mill Valley, California.
Hi, Ron.
Yes, Ron.
And I wanted to mention to Lauren, is he aware of the Senator Barbara Boxer's bill, 450 Count Every Vote Act, which was introduced last year, that's supposed to get a paper trail?
These do exist. These bills do exist.
Right.
The problem is that it is difficult to get it at the federal level. I mean, individual states are moving much faster on this than the feds are.
See, I understand that it's stuck in committee, that Trent Lott and Christopher Dodd, they can't seem to get it out of committee.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to see why honest politicians would want to prevent honest voting, but, you know, it's a strange world.
It is a strange world, isn't it? First-time caller line, you're on the air with Lauren Weinstein and Art Bell. How you doing?
Hey, Lauren. Hey, Art. How you guys doing this evening?
Yeah, hi.
I'm fine. Where are you, sir?
I'm actually in Buffalo, New York.
Okay.
Great state of New York. I got a couple of questions for you there, Lauren. I'm really new to this whole computer thing. I mainly surf the internet and play games. I'm into online gaming and whatnot. But there are one thing I haven't heard you guys talk about tonight are the spybot and adware programs that actually steal your bandwidth.
You're absolutely right. We haven't touched on that, but he's right. They do steal bandwidth. There's absolutely no question about it. They slow your computer down. They screw you up, Lauren.
Yeah, they're a real problem, and again, we've had problems getting reasonable laws passed to make many of those activities illegal. Interestingly enough, I don't know, Art, if you heard about this, but Microsoft was embroiled in something of a PR disaster recently when it turned out that they had been deploying to people's PCs as part of their anti-piracy software a little program that actually made a connection to Microsoft every time the system was booted, and it turned out once a day after
wow.
That hadn't been disclosed.
I had not heard about that.
And that actually, I plead guilty for kind of getting that one out there because I'm the one that originally blogged that story, and then it kind of blew up. The upshot was that Microsoft admitted that they really should have handled that differently. But the interesting aspect was the question of what is spyware. Would you consider that activity to be spyware because it did make connections that we didn't know were being made, as opposed to insidious spyware that like goes through your machine?
Well, all right, let's talk about the insidious. The insidious stuff. Why is that simply not illegal, like hacking?
You have a lot of powerful forces in play. There have been moves now. Much of that is now becoming illegal, but there are definitional problems. And part of what's made this difficult is that we could easily agree that a program that goes into your computer and steals your banking account information, that's illegal, right? That should be illegal.
Yeah.
But there are business models that have been built up on, for example, tracking what people do and then sending them advertisements that pop up on their computer.
Well, that ought to be illegal too.
Right, but that becomes a tougher sell because there's a lot of money involved in that. So people get into this, they're kind of trying to cut a very thin line and say, well, this is legal, but this is legitimate business. And that slows the whole process down when those kinds of arguments occur, as you can imagine.
Listen, buddy, we're out of time. It's been a wonderful program. I want you to plug your website. It's vortex.com, right?
Yeah, that's the best site to use.
All right, what's on there?
That leads off to all kinds of different things. It leads off to the Privacy Forum and some of my discussions and my blog and things like that. So, and there's some fun stuff on there, too. So it's always of use. And it's free. You don't
it's
have
free.
To pay even a nickel to use it.
That's vortex.com, right?
That's right.
Also, you have another one. That's pfir.org.
Right. That's the People for Internet Responsibility site, and that's where a lot of these policy discussions and issues, position papers and things like that are that relate to many of the issues that we have been discussing this morning.
Lauren, you have been wonderful. Thank you, my friend.
Always a pleasure to join you. Thank you very much, Art.
You have a good night. That's Lauren Weinstein. I'll tell you, folks, what a fabulous program. Tomorrow night, Howard Bloom will be here. It's going to be a good one. I will see you then. From Manila in the Philippines, I'm Art Bell. Good night.